My name is Sarah Abravaya-Stein, and I have the pleasure of being the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Director of the Levy Center for Jewish Studies. It's wonderful to welcome so many people here today, especially on such a rainy day, which I know in L.A. inhibits our every movement. So it shows your loyalty to this academic cause. We are really excited today to welcome Dr. Liron Yadgar to speak with us. He is this year's visiting UCLA Viterbi visiting professor and postdoctoral scholar in Mediterranean Jewish Studies, which is a position supported by the Viterbi family for some years, and we are very, very grateful to their support. Dr. Yadgar earned his BA and his MA from Tel Aviv University and received his PhD from the University of Chicago in 2016. His research examines the history of Jewish communities in the Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt and Syria from the middle of the 13th century to the early 16th century, and Jewish-Muslim interaction and intellectual exchange during the late Middle Islamic period. He is currently, while in residence at UCLA, working on his first book, which concerns the representations and knowledge of Jews, Judaism, and the Hebrew Bible in the works of two prominent theologians of 14th century Damascus, Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. Previously, Professor Yadgar served as the Jacob and Hilda Blaustein Postdoctoral Associate in the Judaic Studies Program of Yale University, and it's truly a pleasure to have him part of our academic community this year, where he is spending time conducting his research, teaching, and participating in the communities of not only the Levy Center, but the Center for Near Eastern Studies, which is a co-sponsor of this event, and also the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures, through which his course is offered. So we are very pleased to welcome Professor Yadgar to speak with us today on the subject of the legend of Khaybar, a Jewish kingdom in the Arabian desert. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Let me begin by expressing my deep thanks to the Ellen Levy Center for Jewish Studies and the chair, Professor Sarah Abravaya-Stein, for honoring me with the invitation to speak here today, and especially to the Viterbi Family Program for its commitment in advancing scholarship concerning the Jewish communities of the Mediterranean world. I thank all of those who made this presentation today possible, and my colleagues at the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations for the warm reception and hospitality during my visiting professorship on this campus. So my presentation today is going to be a bit out of the usual. We are going to look at some slides on the PowerPoint, but also in the handouts. Hopefully you all have a copy of the handout. We'll be looking at different texts and passages that discuss the Khaybari legend, what I call the Khaybari legend, throughout the ages. We'll be looking at it together from its earliest times, from the time of the rise of Islam up until more or less 100 years ago or so, when the Zionist pioneers came to the land of Israel. And they were again fascinated and writing and speaking about the Khaybars of the Arabian Peninsula or the Khaybars of what they could find in Palestine. So the presentation today is going to take us to the Arabian Peninsula. Nowadays, we mostly associate Arabia to be the cradle of Islamic civilization and having in it the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, where the Prophet Muhammad lived and operated between 570 and 632. And these are, of course, the spiritual center of and the sites of pilgrimage for millions of Muslims around the world. A recent photo essay that was published on the website of the Washington Post last Monday reminds us of the civilizations that lived in the Arabian Peninsula before Islam. The essay is concerned with the Nabataean ruins of two cities, Al-Ula and Madain Saleh, and the new initiative led by the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to attract foreign tourists to these sites. which at the moment are less known than their sister city, Petra, or Petra, in Jordan. Al-Ula and Madain Saleh were the center of the Nabatean state centuries before the emergence of Islam, and potentially they could become attractions for visitors in Saudi Arabia because of their cultural and archaeological significance for the cultures of the pre-Islamic New East. Now, of course, this lecture is about the Jews, and the present is about the Jews. So the Jews were among the inhabitants of the Arabian Peninsula since ancient times. And my presentation today is about the Jews of one specific site, the oasis of Khaybar, in Western Arabia, in this region that is holy to the Muslims, in the region that is named in Arabic Hijaz. This oasis, this settlement of Khaybar, is located about 95 miles north of Medina. So this is, of course, in Western Saudi Arabia today. And this is in an old map of the pre-Islamic peninsula. You see here Khaybar, as well as Medina, the city of the Prophet, and Mecca, the holy city to Islam. It is not entirely clear when Jews arrived to Arabia and settled in its desert, and the evidence of Jewish sources from the antique period on this matter is scarce. It does not allow us to fully investigate the origins of the Jews in the Arabian Peninsula, and to study the social organization of their communities, their intellectual culture, and their relations to the great centers of Judaism in Palestine and Babylonia. In most cases, we have to rely on Jewish and non-Jewish sources, some of them Muslim materials, which are concerned with the Jews in the pre-Islamic Arabia, but were written down in the mid-8th century and later. Muslim historians, for example, were mostly interested in studying the inhabitants of Arabia in the time of the Prophet Muhammad and in preserving the poetry of the Arab peoples before Islam, but not so much in exploring Jewish history in the peninsula throughout the ages. The evidence these Muslim writers present regarding the origins of the Jews in Western Arabia is conflicting, and it is clear that they could not conclusively answer in what time period exactly Jews arrived to the region that became Islam's holiest territory. Among the traditions that they present us is that the Jews of Arabia were refugees of the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem by the Babylonians in the 6th century before the Common Era, the destruction of the second temple by the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era, and there are other traditions identifying the first settlers to be from the time of David and Solomon, or from Moses' expeditions against the Amalekites in the desert during the Exodus from Egypt. Still other sources speak of Arab clans who adopted Judaism due to the reverence they felt for the scholarly traditions among the Jews. Muslim sources report of the wealth of the Khaybari Jews. This is a YouTube video that you could all actually watch. It's actually a very short one. It's 2 minutes or so. Aliyot Khaybar min Bani Israel, where the Jews of Khaybar, descendants of the children of Israel, and according to the speaker in this video, we should not include the Khaybari Jews to be among the descendants of the biblical children of Israel. What we find is actually converts to Judaism from among the pagan Arab clans. Muslim sources report of the wealth of Khaybari Jews in the time of Muhammad and of its residents being active in agriculture and commerce. In addition, some of these Khaybari Jews were known as craftsmen and moneylenders, and like the rest of the Jews in the Arabian Peninsula, they were fully integrated in the culture of its wider Arab society. Having Arabic names and speaking Arabic and carrying their activities in collaboration with the Arab tribesmen. One 13th century geographer states that the name of the settlement Khaybar derives from the dialect of the local Jews, meaning a fortification, and he finds the Jewish fortification that had been mentioned in the accounts about Muhammad's lifetime to be the origin of this place name. In his text, one finds 7 fortifications to be located in these settlements of Khaybar, so he enumerates them. These are the Hesenaim, Hesen al-Kamus, Hesenashik, and so on. In the year 628, the Prophet Muhammad attacked Khaybar and annexed it to the territories under the control of his state. The location of Medina, his city, between Khaybar and Mecca, made the situation for him precarious. It was in Medina to which the Prophet migrated from his native town Mecca 6 years earlier, in 622, that Muhammad found an extremely powerful Jewish community. And in a series of negotiations and military campaigns, he managed to overcome the Jewish opposition in Medina and to expel the remains of Jews from the city. Driven out of Medina, some of Muhammad's Jewish rivals found refuge in Khaybar. One can understand, therefore, Muhammad's reason in attacking Khaybar in the necessity of destroying his enemies and to satisfy the need for booty for his followers. With removing the danger of Jewish hostility north of Medina, he was capable to direct his attention toward capturing Mecca, that was for him the biggest prize to capture. Michaleki reports of a Muslim source according to which the Jews of Khaybar and the Meccans had a pre-existing alliance. Thus, by attacking Khaybar, Muhammad removed an obstacle on his way of conquering Mecca. It took the Jews of Khaybar about 45 days to surrender to the Muslims, and by the end of the siege over their fortifications, Muhammad agreed to let the Jews remain in the oasis and to cultivate it on the condition to hand one half of their produce to the Muslims. Muslim sources report of two Jewish women, and this is what you'll actually find from now in the handout. These two women were from among those who were captured in Khaybar. The first is Safiya, daughter of Huyay ibn Akhtab. She was the wife of one of the leaders of the Jewish Banu Nadir from Medina, who found refuge in Khaybar. The name of her husband is Kanina ibn Arabi, and he was killed during the battle over Khaybar. Muhammad, according to the Muslim accounts, was intrigued by Safiya's great beauty. He released her from her captivity and he made her his wife. Having both her father and her husband killed by the Prophet, her agreement to marry him and to adopt Islam immediately makes this case even more significant for the Muslims. Al-Waqidi's account includes a report of Safiya prior to the battle in Khaybar, in which she had a dream that predicts her marriage to the Prophet of Islam. So this is the first text in the handout. This is reported from Safiya, and it is included in one of the accounts or books of the expeditions, the battles of the Prophet against his enemies, both Jews and pagans, of course, in the Arabian Peninsula. Safiya speaks about her husband. He married me. He was my husband for some days before the messenger of God arrived at Khaybar. He moved me to his fortress in Sulalim, where I saw in my sleep that the moon had approached from Yathrib, which is Medina, and had fallen in my lap. I mentioned that to Kinana, my husband, and he struck my eye, and he turned green. The messenger of God looked at it when I came to him, and he asked me about it, and I informed him about it. So this is the miracles that surround the Prophet of Islam, right? In this case, it's a Jewish woman who is going to be his wife. She's going to be one of the mothers of the believers, according to the Muslim tradition. Even though she accepted Islam and she is one of the Muslim wives of the Prophet, the Muslim accounts and traditions still speak about some verbal attacks against her, reminding her of her Jewish origin. And she is reported to say, because this is what the Prophet Muhammad instructs her, that she is the daughter of Harun, that she relates to Aaron from the Jewish Bible, the brother of Moses. So by relating to her genealogy, to her descent from the great biblical figures, Aaron is also mentioned in the Quran, This is how she could actually silence her opposers from the household, from the wives, the other wives of the Prophet Muhammad in the city of Medina. The second case, the second woman that is mentioned, is a completely different case. So it presents us a woman who was trying to avenge the killing of her family members in the same battle over Khaybar. And this is the person named as Zainab. When the Messenger of God rested from his labor, Zainab bint al-Kharith, the wife of Salam ibn Miksham, served him a roast sheep. She had asked what part of the sheep the Messenger of God liked best and was told that it was a foreleg. So she loaded that part with poison and she poisoned the rest of the sheep too. Then she brought it. When she set it before the Messenger of God, he took the foreleg and chewed a bit of it. But he did not swallow it. With him was Bisha, and like the Messenger of God, he took some part of it, but Bisha, however, swallowed it while the Messenger of God spat it out, saying, "This bone informs me that it has been poisoned." Then he summoned the woman, and she confessed. He asked, "What led you to do this?" She said, "What if he afflicted my people is not hidden from you." So I said, "If he is a prophet, he will be informed. But if he is a king, I shall be rid of him." The prophet forgave her. So it shows us some kind of the leniency, the tolerance of the prophet of Islam, even towards those who are trying to assassinate and to end his life. Bishr, nonetheless, actually died of what he ate, the poisoned food. And the account continues that, according to at least to this tradition, that during his illness, while he was on his deathbed, he reported that to the mother of Bishr, the same guy who was dying after the battle in Khaybar. The mother of Bishr, "At this moment I feel my aorta being severed because of the food I ate with your son at Khaybar. The Muslims believe that in addition of the honor of prophethood that God granted him, the Messenger of God died a martyr." In this case, we have a martyr, we have a shaheed in Islam, a person who did not die in the battlefield, unlike many of his followers, of course, in the time of the great expeditions and the expansion of Islam. This is a man who died on his bed, at home, in Medina. But the report says that it actually happened because of the same poison that ran in his blood, probably a century or more, actually, afterwards, right? And not only that his death came to him because of this Jewish woman from Khaybar, right? So we have a kind of a circulation of text, and this is what the first kind of part of what I'm presenting now, circulation of text that concern Khaybar, the Jews of this town, and their encounter with the Prophet of Islam, right? Not so much about what was the history before coming to this town or the life in the oasis. What concerned the Muslim historians are the accounts about the Prophet and about the emergence of his new religion. Now, after the death of the Prophet, Muslim sources report that the Caliph Umar, who succeeded the Prophet of Islam and ruled the early Islamic state between 634 and 644, ordered the expulsion of Jews and Christians from the Hijaz, from this holy territory in Western Arabia. And he followed what was considered to be a statement from the mouth of the Prophet, a hadith. The Prophet is reportedly saying two religions should not remain in the peninsula or in the land of the Arabs. And following this instruction, 10 years or so, or maybe even more, after the death of the Prophet, Umar is the one to follow this instruction, according to what the tradition says. Now, it is not entirely clear, however, if the policy of banning non-Muslims from residing in the Hijaz was indeed practiced already during Umar's caliphate, or perhaps was practiced much longer after his lifetime. Who were the populations who were expelled from the Hijaz, and to what locations exactly they were exiled? And some traditions state that the Hebrew Jews were exiled to Syria, more specifically maybe to Palestine. Some identify Jericho or the Jordan Valley to be the new locations of these exiles from Khaybar. Right? So it takes us actually to the last part of this presentation, when these new Zionist pioneers come to the land. Many of them, of course, from Eastern Europe or from Russia, and they are trying to rediscover Jewish roots, the Hebrew roots, in pre-state Palestine, pre-48 Palestine. Now, it seems that from this point onward, the Hebrew Jews should actually disappear. They are part of the larger populations of Muslims and non-Muslims in Syria and Palestine, maybe elsewhere, if they have left the territories that I've mentioned. Nonetheless, they do appear in the sources, both the Muslim sources and the Jewish sources, up until, of course, the modern time. This is what I mentioned before about the Zionist literature dealing with the Hebrew Jews. Now, one of the concerns of Muslim legalists from the Middle Ages up until modern times as well, because the evidence comes many times from Yemen, is that Jews presented to the Muslim authorities, to the Muslim state, in different time periods and in different lands, which include, again, Yemen, but also Egypt, Iraq, and even as far as Morocco, evidence for some kind of a bill of rights, a letter of protection that was supposedly written by the Prophet Muhammad or by his successor Ali ibn Abi Talib, and was submitted to the Jews of Khaybar. This bill of grants protects the Jews of Khaybar from the regular stipulations that were part of the Islamic non-Islamic contract, when Jews and Christians were actually had to obey some kind of a pact or a contract with the Muslim state, according to which they live their lives in humiliation, humility. They follow a long list of stipulations, and the most important one of these, probably the most difficult one for them, was paying a poll tax, in Arabic jizya, to the Muslim state. And that was true throughout the ages, probably from the earliest times of Islam to the modern age. In some countries and some time periods, the burden of paying the poll tax or the burden of these anti-Jewish stipulations, anti-Christian stipulations, if you'd like, was much heavier than in other time periods. So maybe these time periods were those that brought forth this supposedly letter that protects Jews from any kind of harassment from the side of the Muslim state or the Muslim ruler, and so on. Now, the Muslim historians, and probably the first reports about this, come from around the 11th century. As-Sakhawi, which is the second text on the handout, is a very late text, but it refers to what became to be the classical study case of these forged letters of Jews. Now, this text presents both the problem from the point of view of historians or legalists, Muslim legalists, Muslim historians, and then what they consider to be the solution, that this is actually some kind of a fraud written by the hands of the Jews. Now, this text that is under the title of, to some degree, of the importance of history, appears in an introduction to a book that deals with the writings of the writings or traditions that are reported to be from the mouth of the Prophet Muhammad or relate to his lifetime, his practices, his way of life, and so on. This is what is called in Arabic hadith. So this is the book that protects the traditions of studying hadith critically, right? And this is one of these accounts that appear in the introduction to the book. History often helps to discover falsification in documents and the like. It may show that the judge before whom the deposition in a case was made, or the witness, or some other participant in a case, or the like, died prior to the date of the document. For instance, some Jew presented a document which he claimed was a letter of Muhammad exempting the Jewish inhabitants of Khaybar from the payment of the poll tax. The document was signed by witnesses from among the men around Muhammad, right? So these are, of course, the followers of the Prophet Muhammad, what is called in Arabic the companions of the Prophet. Among the signatures, it is said, one was of Ali ibn Abi Talib, one of his successors, one of the successors of the Prophet. Now in 447, in the year 1055 or 1056, this document was brought before the chief government official, Abu al-Qasim Ali, the vizier of the Abbasid Caliph Al-Qa'im. Ali submitted it to the great authority in the religious sciences, Abu Bakr al-Khatib al-Baghdadi, who was extremely well known as an historian, both of his city, the city of Baghdad, but also because of his hadith studies. Al-Khatib studied it and declared it to be falsification. And then again and again, you see in these similar accounts that Jews are being accused for falsifying these documents. Asked upon what he based his opinion, he said, the conquest of Khaybar took place in the year 7, according to the Islamic calendar. And this document contains the signature of Muawiyah, who became a Muslim only in the year of the conquest of Mecca, which happened a year after, in the year 8 of the Hijri calendar. It also contains the signature of Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, who had died on the day of the Banu Qurayza, 2 years before the conquest of Khaybar. So we have more than one discrepancy with the people supposedly signing this bill of rights to the Jews of Khaybar. Ali fully approved of this argumentation of Al-Khatib and based the decision in the matter upon it. The Jews were not granted the tax exemption, which was stipulated in the document, because it had become clear that it was a falsification. Now, it's not only that the Muslim sources throughout the ages, from the 11th century and onwards, report about these fraudulent letters from the hands of the Prophet or from Ali ibn Abi Talib. We also have the evidence from the Cairo Geniza. So the Cairo Geniza, this repository of documents from the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Old Cairo, in is Fustat in Arabic, also preserved at least one letter that is supposedly written down by Muhammad, actually dictated by Muhammad to Ali ibn Abi Talib, his successor and his close companion, his son-in-law in this case. And the letter says, well, not only that the Jews of Khaybar should not pay the jizya and not any of the stipulations should come upon them and do not strike them with those stipulations. It goes on to say, this is in the framework of this document, because we have like a document inside of a document, a story within a story. It says, well, the Jews of Khaybar were extremely helpful for the Prophet of Islam during his battles against his enemies. And not only that, they joined his battles, his campaigns against his enemies. They also were ready to desecrate the Sabbath in honor of the Prophet of Islam. So according to this tradition, one of the mothers, the great matriarchs of the Highbury Jews. He's calling the Highbury Jews out of their expeditions to return back home to the settlement, return in order to make the prayer for the Sabbath, because the Sabbath is actually starting and they should actually make the prayer. But the Jews say, we have no Sabbath and we have no holiday as long as the Prophet of Islam fights his battles, right? So this is some kind of a sign for their loyalty for the Prophet of Islam. And modern scholars who read these texts were familiar with some of those Muslim documents, but they also try to criticize and to read it again from new points of criticism and analysis, right, with the other Muslim sources, certainly with the accounts about the life of the Prophet. And they find more and more discrepancies, right, like not only in the term of the dates or the people being mentioned, but certainly in the story that speaks about the Highbury Jews being loyal to Muhammad, right? Just think about the story of Zainab, the famous story of Zainab trying to kill the Prophet because she's trying to avenge the killing of her family members. And in this case, Khaybar is being mentioned in one of the first lines in this letter. It starts with the Bismillah. It addresses Muslims. It speaks about a man from Khaybar who tells a story about how the Jews of Khaybar used to participate in the battles of the Prophet, to be a part of his campaigns. And then it goes into giving us a copy of this letter, supposedly from the hands of Muhammad, granting rights to the Jews of Khaybar. Now, if you move from the old text to the second part, to some degree, of this presentation, we are far removed from the early times of Islam. I'll be moving actually to Benjamin of Tudela. Probably many of you are familiar with both Benjamin of Tudela and also the next person to be mentioned here, Obadiah of Bertinoro. So Benjamin of Tudela is known to be a great traveler from the Iberian Peninsula. The text that he left behind him, the itinerary, the travelogue, says that he traveled all the way to China. Now, the text provides some materials, information, pieces of information. Some of these could be considered to be realistic. Some of these are considered to be completely unrealistic, and probably with Benjamin of Tudela, we can identify the Jewish legend of Khaybar, as I named it here, actually, for the title of this talk. Now, scholars have already studied some of those legends that are included in the text of Benjamin of Tudela. They also tried to ask what were the motives for Benjamin to travel around the Jewish world in the Orient, all the way to China, if he has done such a thing. You could probably think of other great travelers, adventurers, both Jews and non-Jews. We can think of the Muslim travelers, but also of people like Marco Polo, who traveled to the eastern lands. In the case of Benjamin of Tudela, more than once, he mentions the 10 lost tribes as one of these communities about which he could actually report to the Jews who live, of course, in Europe, right? When he comes back home to Spain and to report about what he has experienced, he has seen, witnessed with his own eyes. So the reports of the East include Iraq. They also include the text, the account of him witnessing both the great caliph of the Abbasid Empire in the city of Baghdad, but also the exilarch, the head of the Jewish exile in the Iraqi lands. And for Benjamin of Tudela, it is extremely important. If you read more than one account on more than one passage. Certainly if you compare one passage to another passage, in the background, you could actually see him referring to this biblical verse that says, this is Genesis 49, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. And this verse was a centerpiece of the polemic between Jews and Christians and Muslims throughout the ages, probably from the earliest times of Christianity, when the idea was that with the destruction of the two temples, we do not see any example for Jews owning their own state or a kingdom. Therefore, there is something wrong in the understanding of Jews, of their scepter shall not be depart from their tribe, from their people, from Judah, right? And the scepter has been handed to Christianity with the coming of the Messiah, of Jesus. With the stories of the 10 lost tribes, we see old biblical communities, the biblical tribes, and according to these stories, they do have some authority in their lands, right? They do not suffer, as actually Benjamin of Tudela tells us in this case about the Jews of Chaibar, they do not suffer the yoke of the Gentiles, neither Christians nor Muslims, right? Here dwell the Jews called Chaibar, the men of Taima, the same city that is actually also in the map that I showed you beforehand. And Taima is their seat of government. It is a great city, and the extent of their land is 16 days' journey. It is surrounded by mountains, the mountains of the north. The Jews own many large fortified cities. The yoke of Gentiles is not upon them, and this could be, again, some kind of a reference to the biblical verse of the scepter shall not be departed from Judah. They go forth to pillage and to capture booty from distant lands, in conjunction with the Arabs, their neighbors and allies. The sons of Arabia dwell in tents, and they make the desert their home. They own no houses, and they go forth to pillage and to capture booty in the land of Shinar and Yemen. All the neighbors of these Jews go in fear of them. Among them are huntsmen and owners of cattle. The land is extensive, and they have in their midst learned and wise men. They give the teeth of all of their possess into the scholars who sit in the house of their learning, also to the poor Israelites and to the recluses who are the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. In this case, the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem is actually a reference to the Karaite communities in Palestine, in Jerusalem. And those who do not eat meat and do not taste wine and sit clad in garments in black, mourning for the destruction of the Jewish temple. And it goes on to say that the people say that the men of Chaibar belong to the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Menasheh. Whom Shlamansar, king of Assyria, led Ephraim into captivity. They have built strongly fortified cities and made war upon all other kingdoms. No man can readily reach their territory because it is a march of 18 days' journey through the desert, which is altogether uninhabited, so that no one can enter the land. And Chaibar is a very large city with 50,000 Jews. In this case, he probably exaggerates, in more than one case, actually, with the numbers
that he... Just for a moment, clarify the date, because isn't late 20... I'm reading it wrong. It's late 12th century.
So according to most historians, Joshua Prather, who studied this travelogue, he traveled to the east around 1165, 1171 or so, including visiting the cities of Jerusalem and giving us the account of Crusader Jerusalem and the churches upon the Temple Mount. Also, Cairo, just before or very shortly after the coming of Maimonides to the same city. So it gives us also the account of the two synagogues that existed in the city and other descriptions of Cairo. Maybe some of them actually based on some Arabic materials. We do know that Benjamin of Tudela, even though he came from Christian Spain, had some knowledge of Arabic. And it seems that at least in one legend that speaks about the grave of Daniel, the prophet Daniel, in Iraq, he actually refers to a Muslim legend that says that Daniel was buried in some kind of coffin made out of glass. This is something that appears in the Muslim sources. It also appears in the travelogue of Benjamin of Tudela, which is actually the most important book of travels from the Middle Ages. So now, if Benjamin of Tudela is the beginning of those accounts about Khaybar, about the might, about the relations to the other nations, peoples, communities around them, we see some of those elements coming up again and again, certainly up until the modern times. You could see, of course, this translation of Benjamin of Tudela. The text of Benjamin was extremely popular in Europe, both among Jews and Christians, because of the tales and the accounts that he could tell about the Orient, right? About Jews, about Muslims, Christians in the Orient. Certainly also because of his interest in the 10 lost tribes. And with the revolution of the printing press, the book became popular not only in Hebrew, but also in Latin and Spanish and other languages. This is how actually for many generations, including Jews of the 19th century and the 20th century, Jews referred again and again, both in Hebrew and in Yiddish and all of the other languages, they refer to this account of Khaybar in Benjamin of Tudela's travelogue, or they make allusions to the same description. You know, the elements that we find later on from this text onwards is that the Jews of Khaybar dwell in the Arabian Peninsula despite those accounts that speak about their expulsion in the Muslim sources, that they live in the Arabian Peninsula in the desert among the Bedouins, that they live independently and do not fear the Gentiles. They are people of great physical power and they take pillage from the Muslims. And later texts refer to them as collecting tax or tariff from the pilgrims who come to the holy city of Mecca. They are extremely pious. In Benjamin of Tudela's text, they have some relation to the Karaites in Jerusalem, or maybe also to the exilarch in Baghdad. So they keep some kind of a correspondence between the Arabian Peninsula, between Khaybar and Baghdad, the great seat of the Muslim Empire. Some reports speak about them to be the descendants of the biblical Rechabites, and we'll see it here shortly in the handout. And they belong to the 10 lost tribes, right? Or at least they belong to 3 of those lost tribes from the Bible. Reuven, Gad, and half of the Menasheh. Okay? Now, from the 12th century, we move on to Obadiah of Bertinoro, and we see some kind of a trend of Italian Jews leaving Europe to live in the Holy Land, in the land of Israel, and they report back of their account of their lifetime, of their meetings with Jews and Christians in the Holy Land, but also of all of kinds of stories, tales, legends concerning the 10 lost tribes. In the case of Obadiah of Bertinoro, who died around 1515, we see again, even though it doesn't really refer to the name Khaybar, he has the same elements that speak about Jews living in the Arabian desert, and so on, the same elements that I mentioned before, right? So another matter that is known in these regions is that the Ishmaelites who make the pilgrimage from Egypt to their shrine in Mecca, They cross that vast and dreadful wilderness, and they often have with them at least 4,000 camels. Occasionally, they encounter in that wilderness a mighty people of giants. One of them could chase 1,000 of Muslims, and the Ishmaelites called them Al-Aribis El-Sadai, meaning the Arabs, sons of El Shaddai, because in their battle cry, they always refer to El Shaddai, God Almighty, which is biblical. The Ishmaelites testify that these people can carry the camel load in one arm, while the other holds the sword to fight back. And it is known that these are Jews, and some say that these are the Rechabites. And in this case, both the mixture of the information in Benjamin of Tudela and what we find in Obadiah's text is what we'll find later on again and again in the later texts that deal with the Hebrew Jews. Now, as for the Rechabites, this is supposedly some kind of a Jewish sect from the age of the prophet Jeremiah. They are reported to be, or they have been, at least they are being mentioned in the book of Jeremiah, as some kind of a group that relate to a person named Yonadav ben Rechab, Rechav in Hebrew, and they follow his instructions zealously, right? They do not drink wine. It, again, actually it connects us to the Benjamin of Tudela's text regarding the wine not being drunk by the Karaites, the mourners of Zion. So they do not drink wine, they do not dwell in houses, they do not own fields, and they would rather live in the tents. To some degree, it connects them to some kind of a Bedouin nomad peoples, as we see the Hebrews, right? And Obadiah of Bethunor, probably because of his source, or because of the source that he had in front of him, or because of the source probably that he heard, right? Oral traditions that circulated and came to his attention, reports that those people, the giant people who chased the Muslim pilgrims, are actually the descendants of Rechab. And then you could ask yourself, like, why is this reference to Rechab, the Rechabites? You could actually give different interpretations also to this relation between the Hebrews and the Rechabites. So one, of course, is because of this piety that is associated with the Rechabites and the Hebrews, right? But probably also because of the similarity of the names when they're written down in the Hebrew script. So it is common to write Chayba, Kaf, Yud, Bet, Resh, Rechav, Resh, Kaf, Bet. It has also been proposed that Chayba should be maybe identified with a location to which the 10 lost tribes were exiled in the Bible. So this is now Chavor, the river Chavor. And there could be probably also other explanations that discuss these relations between one name or for a location or for a people and the Hebrew Jews. Some of these, or many of these, actually relate to the Bible. The next thing in the handout is, again, some kind of adventure that comes a bit later on, but supposedly this is a man who comes from the eastern lands and travels all the way to Europe. And this man in this book that Miriam Eliav Feldon published, an imposter, right? In another case of an imposter, like we already discussed the case of forgery, so this is a case for a man who fashionizes himself, who presents himself to be some kind of descent or belonging to a royal family from the desert of Chabor. So again, many times, scholars, historians have related this Chabor, desert of Chabor, to the river of Chabor, which is mentioned in the Bible, in the Book of Kings. Nonetheless, if you compare in the handout between the tribes mentioned in David Aruveni's case and the account of Benjamin of Tudela, you find that the same tribes are actually mentioned, right? The same tribes. Reuven, Menashe, Gad. These are the same tribes mentioned in both texts. And we could actually understand Chabor to be none other than Chaibar, right? Not only that, he speaks about being coming from the desert. And many scholars throughout the ages, because of the attraction, because of the fascination with this person, they relate to him to be some kind of an oriental man. But his exact origin is not entirely clear. So some say he came from Yemen, maybe some other Arab country. Supposedly he had some knowledge of Arabic, of what is in the Hebrew language, Agarite language, and knowing also some Hebrew. And also because of his appearance, so some kind of a dark-skinned man coming from the Orient and speaking in Arabic and Hebrew and presenting himself to be a man of the desert dwellers, right? In this case, of some kind of a royal family from the desert of Chabor. So when we accumulate and compare the texts and put them together, you could actually find the origin of this man to be from the same community of the Chabaris in the Arabian Peninsula. So I already mentioned this fascination, especially with the text of Benjamin of Tudela and the circulation of stories, both for people who were living, studying, reading in Europe, but also for people who were traveling to the east. This could be to Palestine or to Egypt or to Iraq, certainly to the Arabian Peninsula, to Yemen, which is of course located in the southern part of the peninsula. And they again try to discover, rediscover, find the truth about the Chaibari Jews. Where are they exactly? Where can we find them exactly? That was the big question. Now, the literature that was written in Palestine by the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, we have, of course, a growing number of references to the Arab population, the majority of the land in Palestine. The author, Ehud Ben Ezer, himself a person fascinated with Arab-Jewish relations in the Hebrew literature, in modern Hebrew literature, he identified several motifs concerning Jewish-Arab relations in this early literature of pre-1948 period. The first motive that he has discussed is the shared Semitic ancestry of the two nations, of the Arabs and the Jews, and certainly the affinity between Arabic and Hebrew, right? So more and more Jews, certainly those who came to the land, refer to this ancestry. We all belong to the same biblical nations. We all refer to Abraham. We all come from the loins of Abraham through Ishmael and Isaac. The second motif that he finds in this literature is this fascination of the Hebrew writers with the scenery of the Holy Land and with the deserts of the Holy Land, right? So it takes us again to the discussions of the Bedouins. And now there's actually a new book published by Yael Zorbavel about the desert in the Zionist and Israeli literature. The third motif is the Arabization of the inhabitants of Palestine, trying to figure out what does it mean exactly for those Arabs in Palestine to be Arabs. What kind of Arabs are they exactly? According to the perception that we find in this literature that was written in Palestine before 48, certainly even afterwards, the Muslim inhabitants of Palestine are in fact the descendants of Jews who were forced to convert to Islam during the Arab conquest. A testimony of a colleague of Yitzhak Ben Zvi, the historian and second president of Israel, presents this concept. So this colleague says that Ben Zvi was considering the Judaization of Arabs. Ever since he came to this idea, he could not stop to investigate and to search after their Jewish origins. When the Arabs will find that they are the descendants of Jews, they might convert to Judaism and return to the source. If not most of them, perhaps some of them. It is doubtful that that was really what Ben Zvi wished for, but that was clearly his wishful thinking. End of quote. So this again takes us to how to understand the expansion of Islam and to the peoples who live in Palestine. Who are they exactly? Are they Arabs? Or maybe you should actually find in them or among them some remains of the great Jewish past, right? Long before the Muslims in this land, right? The Palestinians, of course. The fourth motif that Ben Ezra finds in the literature is the perceived similarity between the Arabs of Palestine in the 20th century and the biblical forefathers, right? And we have descriptions both in the literature but also in the arts, when the local populations of the East, the Oriental peoples, are actually some kind of an emblem for the great biblical figures. Certainly when they met the Yemeni Jews, they were fascinated with their appearance, with their looks, their Oriental looks. They saw, the Zionists saw in the Yemeni Jews some kind of a symbol for the existence of the Jewish people throughout the ages. And one finds all of those motifs of Ben Ezra's account in the stories and descriptions of the Hebrew Jews in Palestine, long after Obadiah of Bertinoro and Benjamin of Tudela. So it was already in 1882, very closely to the time of the immigration of Jews from Yemen to the Holy Land, that Naftali Herzimber, the author of Hatikva, the National Anthem of Israel, was composing this poem that you also have in the handout, The Yemenites. And it's a very bitter poem, to some degree criticizing the Yemenites that he had met in Jerusalem. He composes this poem and he publishes it in the United States when he comes to live in this country. So not to you, my Yemeni brethren, not to you we have been expecting with yearning eyes. Why have you come, my dear brothers, to add misery to our troubles? Like the rest of us, you suffer of hardship and pain, and like us, you could only weep. To the lost brothers forgotten for thousands of years, from whom we have not heard, the desert dwellers, and like the sons of the Dedanim, who ride their camels in the Arabian wilderness. To them we expect the 10 lost tribes, skilled horsemen who carry their shields. To them we expect the Rechabites, camel riders and great warriors, the sons of Moses, who dwell beyond the Sambatyon River, a nation of honor and fear. So again we see the circulation of the ten lost tribes accounts in the modern literature, right? Of course, I'm not trying to argue this is all one continuous story from ancient times up until the modern time with the Zionists. Each of these accounts or writers add its own flavor to the story. In this case, some kind of a messianic, right, to some degree, right, about life of Jews among the wider Arab population in Palestine, and certainly about what to see in the Zionist project when they feel the hostility of the Arabs around them. So now there are actually more than one story account. Some of these are about real life people, some of these are literary descriptions of the Hebrew Jews. We have Chemda Ben Yehuda's story, The Farm of the Rechabites, which again is some kind of a story that deals with both the biblical Rechabites on the one hand and the Arab Hebrew Jews on the other hand. The protagonist of this story that was published in 1903 for the first time is going out for a search, some kind of a quest after the Hebrew Jews. And only after a series of trials in which he meets Bedouins of the deserts and priests who reside in the Holy Land, he comes to encounter the Hebrew Jews in Palestine. So instead of looking for the Hebrew Jews or the Ten Lost Tribes outside of the borders of the Holy Land, the Hebrew Jews could be found in the Holy Land itself, in Palestine in this case. So this is in Chemda ben Yehuda's story. She is the wife of Eliezer ben Yehuda. Another story that was published in the mid-30s is Shmuel Yosef Agnon's story, Under the Tree, in which a man, a Jewish man, meets a great general of the Muslims, in Hebrew, Sar HaIshmaelim, and this man tells him of his battles in faraway lands, in these distant lands. At one point, he actually meets the Hebrew Jews, and they are being described again with marvelous descriptions of their royalty, of their joy, of their piety, of praying to the one God, of mentioning in their prayers David and Solomon and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And the story ends with a very long, beautiful description of the Hebrew Jews still living among us. This is also what we find in these trials, in this quest after the Ten Lost Tribes, the Hebrew Jews, not only in the literature, but also among real life people, people who lived in Palestine before 48 and after 48, and tried to figure out where, if they could actually locate those Jews. So this is what you actually find in this text that speaks about some kind of a Russian-born Jew who comes to the land, becomes a great guardian, warrior, adventurer, who is himself trying to locate the Hebrew Jews in the Hejaz. And Yitzhak Ben Zvi's text, published again before 48, this is a part of his series of studies, again trying to locate the Hebrew Jews, and unlike maybe other figures, he actually does find a people, a community that says that they are the descendants of the Hebrew Jews from old times. And this is, in this case, in Utah, or nowadays it's actually called Yatta in Israel. It's in the environs of Hebron. And according to these accounts of Ben Zvi, which are still circulated today in Muslim journalism actually, or online on the internet, in the communities, in the Arab communities of Utah, those Muslims themselves refer to their descent from the Hebrew Jews. I think I talked for much longer than I needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Yagar, who has kindly agreed to field questions. We probably have 15 or 20 minutes or so for questions. Perhaps if you're willing, we will gather a few at once and allow you the chance to respond. Please.
It's a fascinating lecture. Why is it that Haifa became a call for jihadists by jihadists to massacre Jews? Alleging that Muhammad, the supporters of Muhammad themselves, supported such a massacre. It goes totally against the message that you have provided in this lecture.
So in Palestine, probably around the riots against the Jews from 1929 onwards, we see more and more reports of Jews, Zionists, writing that the one of the slogans against them is that this refers to, oh, the Jews of Haibar, the Jews of Haibar, we are going to return, or the Prophet of Islam is going to return and to strike you. So this is some kind of a slogan that Palestinians from pre-48 time period have been using, maybe still use even today. And there is actually at least one study that discusses what Palestinians nowadays, more or less nowadays, actually know about the story of Haibar, the conquest of Haibar, the annihilation of this community through their campaigns, the expulsion of the Jews of Haibar, and how they relate and speak about it in modern-day Israel, when they refer, of course, to the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians.
Please.
Yes.
A few decades ago, they found that there are a few tribes. I recall two tribes in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
That they traced them back to the tribe of Daesh. And also we know that there is a passage in the mountain of Afghanistan near the border of Pakistan. It's called Khaybar Strait.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any connection between that Khaybar and the other Khaybar?
So it has been suggested that maybe we should actually see some kind of a connection between the Khaybar, and Khaybar again. I'm not so sure. I don't know about it so much. It's probably because some of these locations have very similar names that, again, even from the biblical times, that those places were conflated from time to time among the adventurers, writers, certainly from people who were traveling for distant lands, coming from outside of the area and writing about those places.
Considering that tribe of Dan was living in Saudi Arabia, in Khaybar, and then they found that the tribe of Dan also in Afghanistan, there might be a relationship between them, or they just got out of the Khaybar in Saudi Arabia and went to east.
So we have this circulation of texts among many Jewish communities around the world. I mean, some of this could cover as far as even America. Some say that the lost tribes have to be found in the new continent of America, not only in what we consider to be the eastern lands or maybe Africa. And scholars who study those traditions again and again find some common links, certainly to the biblical verse that I mentioned before, that the scepter shall not depart from Judah. So what was that kept their uniqueness among the wider society that was not Jewish? What kind of tradition they kept to themselves? What kind of practices from old times? Ways of prayer? These are all things to study, certainly, for folklorists and ethnographs of all kinds. Thank you. Yes?
So you said that there was a feeling the Islamists that there should not be two religions existing on the Arabian Peninsula. Is there more Islamic theological writings or discussions as to why that should be true when they were talking about, quote, the people of the book and sharing the same biblical ancestors?
So, since this is a topic that relates to the early times of Islam, this is now in some kind of a debate, some kind of a controversy. If this was really the case, we do have sources that speak about remains of Jews even in the midst of the Arabian Peninsula. You have to remember that Jews were not expelled from Yemen. And Jews lived in Yemen from ancient times, who knows when they arrived there exactly, right? Up until the foundation of Israel in 1948. If Jews could live in Yemen, what was actually the case for Jews or maybe for Christians in other places of the Arabian Peninsula? It's not entirely clear. It has been suggested that we should not actually take the traditions as what they say per se regarding this Caliph Umar, who was known to be a very strict person in his treatment of Jews and Christians, and that we should actually reevaluate these traditions. With the Khaibari Jews, I think that when we have them spread all around in Iraq, in Egypt, and again, even a text speaking about a bill of rights given to them in Morocco in the 15th century or so, or 16th century, it's quite hard to imagine that Jews still remain in the what is supposedly, to some degree, kind of the heart of Islam because of its spiritual significance, right? So Medina and Mecca, of course, the holy cities of Islam. Today, in Arabic, these are called the holy cities, Al-Haramain, and the king of Saudi Arabia is the guardian of the holy cities, right? And if you look at the photos from these cities, you see signs that say there is no entrance to the non-Muslims to those holy places, right? But probably also throughout the ages, people try, adventurers, European adventurers, Christians also try to come to those places and to visit the holy places. It's almost like entering the Forbidden City, right? Like in China, yeah. Daniel?
Thank you very much for the talk. I've been very interested in the legends of the Lost Tribes Forgotten, but I never really learned much about the Sahari.
I told you, I hope it's going to interest you.
So your talk is very helpful. Two things. First of all, with regard to this forged letter of protection, which I found the whole history very fascinating, I guess is it fair to say that this was something that was especially appealing because the Prophet of Umar explicitly addressed
right.
The Christian community, so it's attractive Jews both to have a different kind of stance under Islam and to be able to claim a letter that was directly to them and not indirectly to them via the Christian community, part one. And then part two, in your talk, it seemed like, so that you first discussed that issue, and then you passed to basically the merging of the Ten Lost Tribe legend with the Khaibar legend, which really we find mostly in these Jewish sources that come out of Christian Europe. I mean, David, relating him from Yemen or whatever, but he enters the story because he shows up in Europe, basically. So I guess I'm wondering, is this a sort of temporal transition in the Khaibari legend, or is it more just that there's a sort of a Christian track, and a Jews and Christian land track, and a Jews and Muslim land track? Is this a letter of protection discourse, is that sort of continue in a Muslim context, or does this... These are the tribes, the Khaibari Jews are the lost tribes that show up in Muslim sources. You follow the question?
Yeah.
What's the relationship between
these two tribes? So first of all, I'll answer your second question first. So I see it, first of all, as some kind of mixture of the Benjamin of Tudela text, of his account, with the later additions, for example, of Obadiah of Bertinoro. And then it's kind of being implemented in the Jewish sources and the Christian sources of Europe. But we see again and again the Europeans, these Jewish European Jews who come to the land, the Italian Jews, who come to the Holy Land, they have accounts in which they report of Jews in the Arabian Peninsula attacking the pilgrims to Mecca. So it's probably some kind of in circulation between all of these lands around the Mediterranean. The same time period, yes? I saw some accounts in Yemen that also report of some stories of this kind. And certainly when people come to Yemen, for example, Jacob Sapir, the great traveler, he also tries to figure out if there is any truth about the Khaibari Jews, and he says, I never heard of such a thing and I don't believe it to be true. So it's some kind of a mixture on both sides of the Mediterranean, if you like, both the Islamic Orient and the European countries. Regarding the Christians, we also know of Christians who held all kinds of documents that were reportedly giving them their rights, in contrast to what is usually known as the Pact of Omar. And there is a scholar who made it in a project, a life project of his in recent years. I believe his last name is Moro. He collects all these documents. He calls these Muhammad's Letters to the Jews of the World. That's one of his books. And one of the books that he published is also some kind of an edition or collection of all of these letters that come from different Christian communities in which they report about them keeping all kinds of letters that protect them from the Muslim state. One of these communities is the Santa Caterina Monastery in the Sinai Peninsula. He sees these documents to be completely reliable, and he collects more people around him to speak and to say the same thing. I think it's quite questionable to see this text to be reliable and to relate to the earliest times of Islam. There's probably more research should be done about this topic, in comparing also the some of these Jewish bills of rights to the Christian bills of rights. Now, this man who has the last name Moro, I believe he actually is a convert to Islam, so he's actually a Muslim. And to some degree, I believe he's trying to project a very positive view of Muhammad's relations with, in this case, with Christians, right? Certainly in the post-9/11 age.
Yeah? If, with your indulgence, Liran, I will ask, there are three hands. I will ask all of them to ask their questions, and then you can have the closing word, since we are approaching our last minute. Please.
Can genetic testing shed some light?
First, we'll have to find the Hyberi Jews, then we'll have to go into the genetics.
An important feature of the Ten Lost Tribes myths and stories and reports was the Sambatian River.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be totally lacking in this 18 miles of desert. So are there any water features in the Khaibar legends?
Thank you. And I believe you had one last question to add to the list.
Yes. Doctor, I just wanted to know about the absence of Jews that we know about in the Hijaz as of the past 100 or so years, at least in clear demographic record. Acknowledging the fact that there was a big community, and still some existing Jews in Yemen today.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in terms of at least homogenizing forces, migration, as you said before, migration to Israel or Palestine? What happened with regards to those Hijazi Jews in the past couple hundred years?
Okay, so I had two questions here. One was about the Sambatian River. The other is about the Jews of the Hijaz in later times. So I don't really see many references to the Sambatian. We have other features of the nature. We see desert, of course, mentioned many times. We see also the mountains protecting the Jews of Khaibar in Obadiah's in a Benjamin of Tudela's text, right? We do know that travelers to the Arabian Peninsula were familiar occasionally with the Sambatian River story. So in a text that was published about 10 years ago or 12 years ago, Ibn al-Mujawir's account of his travels in Yemen, he speaks about, in Arabic, right? This is a Muslim Arabic text. He speaks about the river of the Sabbath. And the story that he gives is certainly from a Jewish informant, right? So this is a case in which the Jewish story of the Sambatian and the Ten Lost Tribes is actually being circulated also among the non-Jews in this case, right? About the Jews of the Hijaz, this is what I mentioned before. This is to some degree some kind of debate where the Jews and the Christians, and who were those Jews and Christians, who were expelled from the Arabian Peninsula in the time period that is considered to be related to the Caliph Umar ibn al-Khattab, yeah? We'll be discussing in my class the Pact of Umar. This is this list of stipulations that are the responsibility for every Jew and Christian who live under the Muslim rule. One of them is, of course, paying the poll tax and obeying all kinds of rules and restrictions, including some that relate to the garments, in order to differentiate the non-Muslim from the Muslim. To this man, we also have this description of him expelling the Jews from the Hijaz. If it was really in his time that both the stipulations that were named after him, the Pact of Umar or the Covenant of Umar, and also the expulsion of the Jews, it's not really entirely clear if you should actually relate it to his time period, maybe probably to a much later time period, right? But Muslim sources many times refer to the earliest times because this is the formative period of Islam. So they refer many times to the Prophet of Islam, to Omar, to Uthman with the codification of the Quran, and to Ali ibn Abi Talib as the most important lawmakers for the early Islamic period. Thank you so much for coming.
I'd like to join me in thanking Professor.